We know, like us, our listeners spend countless hours every week taking care of loved ones, but most probably don't have an estate plan. Sampson McPhee Lawyers can help. Estate planning allows you to make the big decisions now, like who will take care of your kids if you pass away, and allows you to control how your assets will be distributed and managed. Estate planning is extra important for parents, common law partners, and people with blended families. Call Kelly at Sampson McPhee at 902-563-5906 to find out about special pricing for our listeners. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I'm good.
How have you been?
I'm good.
Busy.
Life has been
wild lately.
I feel like we say this every time.
I know.
Busy. Life is wild.
But I've been good. I don't think we recorded in a while. So first of all, we had an exciting in-person event that was awesome.
Did we not?
I don't think we recorded since then.
We didn't?
I don't think so, because we do this. We pour everything we have into this event and then we suffer like a month-long hangover from the event. Not alcohol-induced hangover, just event planning-induced, organizing event.
How do wedding planners do this?
I know. I think they have to stay like emotionally detached from the event in some way. That's a good question. We should have one on and talk about it.
Yeah. An event planner of any sort, really.
Yeah. Because it takes energy.
It does.
But we were planning it, organizing it, running it, leading it. We were wearing many hats.
Yes. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
No, it was awesome.
So fun to plan.
The conversations were incredible.
It's so fun to plan an event with a friend.
Yeah, it is.
Not only planning an event with your friend, but a super exciting event that's going to help so many people.
Yeah, we were passionate about it. We were excited to attend it ourselves.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So excited.
The engagement was so encouraging and inspiring. Like, people had an appetite for the conversations. We had so many questions come in for that. People were into it, I think. So it was great. We had a great turnout. We were worried about the weather, but joke's on us because the place was jammed. It was great. It was awesome. And we reached our fundraising goal.
We did.
So thanks to all of you, we were able to raise enough money so that the Hospital Foundation through the Teal to Heal Fund can raise the mobile GYN assessment cart for our ER, which is incredibly
needed.
Plus
more.
Plus more. How are you?
I'm good. Just came off like a 3-week break from school.
Nice. Much needed.
Yes. Not that long, I don't think. Like, other people in my course would argue that it wasn't long enough. But for me, I felt, let's just keep going.
Yeah.
I definitely learned a lot about myself during these 3 weeks home by myself. I could never work from home. I like to be connecting with people.
Right.
That is one thing I've learned about myself during the pandemic and these last 3 weeks. I need human connection. Not through a screen.
Physical human connection. You need to be sharing space with another
100%.
Person. 100%. Very interesting.
I was saying to Daniel, I don't have to say my husband, you know, I'll know who he is. Because he's saying to me, like, being bored is a privilege.
Yeah.
Stop telling me you're bored. It's driving me nuts. Because he was so like busy at work. But I'm like, no, I think it's okay that I want to get back to work and get back to school. I think a couple of days is always refreshing to like catch up on things or just veg on the couch or whatever.
Right.
But like then I'm like, okay, like I want to get on to the next thing.
Do you think you're always like that? Or is it because this program, you can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel. You'd rather like completion complex, like get it done.
No.
Like you're in it, let's do it, let's get it done.
Daniel tells me I don't know how to relax.
That's what I was getting at, is maybe that's a skill we have to learn how to do. It's just actually relax.
Weekends are hard for us. For the longest time, Daniel works like a typical like 9-to-5 kind of thing.
Right.
But most evenings he's working late. And then on the weekends, he's either on call or he does some electrical work on the weekends and stuff. So he's rarely home. And so Logan and I are just used to doing our own thing. But these last number of weeks, he's been home and we just can't get on the same page. Like, I'm like, let's get up. Let's seize the day. What are we going to do? And he's
right.
Like, I just want to like veg, because he never gets to just do nothing.
Yeah.
And so he was cleaning out his closet. Took him like 4 hours. And I'm just like literally watching the clock to be like, oh my God, like how much longer are we going to do this? Because in my head, I'm like, well, we're together. We should do things.
Right.
We need to like do family activities.
You know, it's funny. Like, I think we could argue a lot of that is consumer culture driven or like society based tells us you need to be productive, but really rest is productive. But we weren't taught that our whole lives, that like rest is productive. So when we're resting, our bodies are like, no, 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 there's things to get done and there's things you're missing out on.
So much
guilt. And there's
things
to be doing. So get up, get up, get up, get up. And we really have to fight that to be like, no, rest is productive. We were actually made to rest. Like our bodies need that.
And then when you're sitting at home with nothing to do, which I would consider it nothing to do, Daniel's like, there's lots of things to do.
There's never nothing.
Like, I don't want to do that stuff. So I was like texting him like, we could do this renovation or like, how cool would this look? Or I was sending him pictures of puppy dogs and then I was sending him pictures of trailers. He's like, you need to get back, like you're spending money. But at one point he was like, why don't you like go do the laundry? And he's like, there's so much laundry that needs to get done. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I'm not going to be honest with you and be telling you that I'm doing nothing if you're going to be like making me feel guilty to do chores. Laundry is your chore.
That is hilarious. It's funny. Like I like what Daniel said about like being bored is a privilege because I think I'm really trying to teach Bo this right now because I think it's something that I wasn't good at growing up and I don't think I am now either. But if you're bored, for some reason, our kids, we taught them really and it's the mediated world, but that bored is a bad thing. Like, oh, I'm bored. My response is like, that's awesome, buddy. Because when you're not bored, you're not creative. Like it's in boredom that we actually experience creativity. So like we should actually be letting our kids and ourselves get bored and be bored and stay bored because it's then that you start to color or you start to write down some poetry or you start to build some fort with your pillows. I don't know. But it's within boredom that creativity is born.
Or anxiety flourishes.
Yeah.
If you're me.
Right. It's that delicate balance.
Yeah, absolutely. I have different personalities,
but to spread some like adult coloring books around here maybe. So when that starts to happen, you can calm yourself back down.
Well, I am back at it.
Yeah.
And I am not bored anymore.
That's right. Careful what you wish for.
I am busy. We've got a special guest on the pod today. Drum roll, please. Sarah McCray, communication expert, is joining us today.
I don't know about expert.
To talk about all things communication. So, as usual, as we invite our guests on, I'm going to officially introduce Sarah.
This is so
although
funny.
She's obviously not a stranger to you, I think it's nice to do an official intro and get to know her on a deeper professional level.
How awkward for me to be sitting here.
I know. I'm going to stare at you in your eyes while I read your bio. Sarah McCray is a senior lab instructor in the Department of Communication and Languages at Cape Breton University, owner of SMR Communication, curator and co-host of The Morning Meeting with Sarah and Jess, mom to Bo, Brooks and Grady, and currently completing studies for a Master of Education in Sustainability, Creativity, and Innovation degree. Instructing in the areas of interpersonal communication, public speaking, media studies, and community studies, Sarah focuses on the intersection of communication, connection, and community, and how the three contribute to transformative learning. She recently contributed a chapter titled Interpersonal Communication, a Critical Reflection Tool, in the forthcoming book, Women and Leadership in Distance Education in Canada. She also co-authored Releasing Something Dangerous into the Wild, a media ecological perspective on the Gen AI academic integrity nexus. In the forthcoming book, International Perspectives on Artificial Intelligence, Large Language Models, Assessments, and Academic Integrity. Sarah is particularly passionate about inclusive language, gendered and mediated communication, and discussing the impact and influence of our language that our language has on the personal and professional climate we create and contribute to.
Woo!
That was a mouthful.
Wow.
You're impressive.
How awkward to sit here and watch you have to read all that.
Okay, let's talk about
so
that though.
So funny.
We are our own worst enemies, imposters. When we have guests on, we are so eager to read their bios because we are always so impressed.
Yeah.
Because it's incredible what people have done in their educational, professional lives.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to ourselves, it's like,
I know. And it's funny. Look. Like we always say there's really cool people doing really cool things, but we don't ever really consider ourselves as those people.
Right.
So it is funny. And I think not to kick down the gendered communication door immediately into this conversation, but I think women often are socialized to be a little bit more humble and quiet about that on their own. Not to say that men don't. I think women experience it often.
Interesting. Maybe bring us back to the very beginning. What kind of brought you into or interested you into this communication world? Did it fall into your lap? Did you specifically want to pursue an education in this area? Tell us a little bit about that. Because I'm actually very curious because I don't think I know the answer to
this. Yeah, I don't think we've ever really talked about it. I think it kind of fell in my lap in the sense that I left high school almost 20 years ago thinking about a degree in social work, actually. And at the time, CBU had a certificate in social work. I'd have to fact check the actual title of it. But I started with my bachelor's degree pursuing that. And it took me not that long to realize that I didn't think it was for me in terms of my emotional capability to do it. Like at that time, at 18, I was like, oh gosh, I think I would take every child home with me. And I think I would wear every feeling that I experienced. And simultaneously, I had registered for a communication course and took it. And I absolutely fell in love. I think a combination of things that I always remind students now when I'm advising and parents especially, is that when you're 18 or 17, I was 17 actually when I started university, you really are taught, hopefully this is changing, but we were really taught, there's like five careers that people talk about. You're going to be a teacher or an engineer or a nurse or a doctor or, but like you don't really know what disciplines are out there. And I was a good student, but I didn't really apply myself in high school. Like I didn't overly challenge myself. I always loved English and English IB, loved to write, but I wasn't taking the physics courses or I wasn't taking advanced math because A, I didn't love it. My brain didn't work that way. And I just studied for a test the night before. And I like really didn't, now that I look back, didn't apply myself. I played basketball. I made sure my grades were always good. You know, I think I finished high school with like a bursary or something, but I wasn't like the top student. And I think that that's because of my effort, not because of my capability, right? I just didn't apply it as much as I could. And the reason I'm saying that is because in university, it's not uncommon to see a student's average drop by like 10 or 15% when they start university because it's a big change, it's a transition. Or the opposite happens where you're finally studying things you're interested in. You're excited to go to school. You apply yourself differently. That was me. I couldn't wait to go to class. I couldn't wait to do the work. Like, was I a stellar student right away? Probably not. Like, I was pretty social as well.
Which is also very important.
It is important. It is important. But I saw my average come up like 20 points. And then that just encouraged me because I was like, wow, I love this and I'm good at it. I understand it. I can apply it. I'm interested in it. I'm curious. And I think that's the most important piece. Like I'm curious to learn more about this. And I was always interested in how people worked, how relationships worked. I'm fascinated by that because I think it takes all kinds of kinds. Anyway, long story short, I took a communication class, loved it. I went to CBU, not because it was a university, literally my backyard, but because they offered a Bachelor of Arts Community Studies degree. And I knew I wanted to study that. And we're one of the only schools in Canada that offer that. And we're one of the only schools in Canada that offer communication, like the discipline of communication as we study it in human behavior.
Oh,
it's a very Americanized like pedagogy and content that we cover. So a lot of communication programs in Canada focus on communications with an S, which would be like public relations. We study human behavior and other things, but we look at cognitive, affective, and behavioral areas of communication across different topics. So I took a course in that. And then the next year I took a couple more. And then I took a gender and communication class and the rest is history. Like that completely changed my whole plan. In two ways. One, I knew I wanted to continue studying communication. So I ended up doing my honors degree in communication, not in social work or not pursuing social work anymore. And two, those classes, the way we teach those classes, it's really embedded. The whole bachelor's degree is experiential learning. So you're very active and engaged in your learning. You're not sitting and listening to lectures all the time. You are actively participating in that. And you learn through doing, through action. And I really got the bug of, I really love facilitating and educating and being a part of the education process. And I just love learning. Like I'm always going to be a lifelong learner, I think. So that really led me to this area. I facilitated labs as an undergraduate student, and you know all about that. You were a facilitator for us as well. So that gave me more of some insight into that feeling of facilitating groups and working with students in different ways. Loved it. I started my career at CBU by being a recruiter and admissions officer. So I was well versed in how the university, like admission requirements and advising students and the whole kind of back end of the university administrative process. I traveled around Canada and the US for a little while, briefly in the US, but mostly in Ontario, every nook and cranny of that province, I like to say. I know some recruiters listen to the podcast, so shout out to the Aero group, because you really are with these people like sun up to sundown in all these crazy places you'll never go again. You're on the same circuit, you know? So recruiting students to come to CBU, and then a job opportunity opened up to be a lab instructor in the department. And it was a long shot, but I went for it and I was successful. So that was almost 15 years ago that I started working at CBU. And I would say about 11 years ago, I started working in the communication department. So yeah, my love for it and my opportunities since then have kind of grown and evolved, and really passionate about the combination of communication and education, and just really communication impacts everything we do. My motto now is, I tell students all the time, regardless if you're in here and you're in your nursing degree or your engineering degree or your arts degree or your business degree, it's one thing to have a good idea. It's another thing entirely to be able to communicate that idea effectively. And this is what we're going to help you do, because regardless of your profession, you are, like it or not, going to be communicating with other people. And most importantly, we need relationships as human beings to thrive. Research shows, like, if you don't have a relationship, you literally die. You need relationship. And I think we can all do better at learning how to be more effective and positive and contributing to healthy relationships and healthy climates that we contribute to in our communities. So that's what keeps me going. Sorry for that very long-winded question, but that's the gist of it.
I have always said, and I know you're going to agree with this, that everyone in the world, every single person should have an interpersonal communication one-on-one
1,000%
crash course. It's so important in everything we do.
I have students every year, Jess, and a lot of them, for example, are in nursing. And a lot of them start the course not with any ill intent, but they start it with the idea like, oh, thank God for this course. It'll be the easiest one I take all semester. And fair enough, their course load's heavy, right? They're learning like very heavy topics. Their schedules are very full. It's very different from the type of learning environment that they're used to. And there's always like a little period of discomfort for some students because of the learning environment. It's experiential learning. You're in small groups sometimes. We're getting vulnerable. I'm asking you to critically reflect on your experiences. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. There's lots of right answers sometimes, right? There's lots of wrong answers. There's lots of right answers. Not everyone's comfortable with that learning environment. But by the end of the semester, and it's my favorite job about teaching, I always say, like, at some point, I promise you, you'll have a light bulb moment where you're like, oh my gosh, I do that. You're going to learn something about yourself or about someone that you have an interpersonal relationship with that's important. And by the end, students always say, most students, not everyone, but most say something like, this is the most important course I took all year. And it's not because of me. It's because of the content they're engaging with, because they see how it's going to make them a better nurse or a more effective engineer or a better sister or husband or boyfriend or father or whatever. That's the most rewarding part of the job, I think, is that you're right. I think everyone can take a crash course in interpersonal communication. Most programs on campus require it as part of their program now. I think there's a reason for that. I think a lot across industries, I think everyone could benefit from that. I also think we have to remember, you can always improve your communication. Like, we joke in our department, we're a bunch of people who study communication all the time. And sometimes we are the worst communicators, right?
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's like, what do they say about a carpenter's house? Like, it's never finished. It's like a communication professional. Sometimes they're the worst at communicating because we know so much that we're reading into things so much deeper sometimes than other people are. Or we're so aware of how we may be communicating that we overthink it and we overthink ourselves right out of like an effective communication situation.
Right.
So it's really funny.
When you look at leadership styles, and give me them, what are they?
Autocratic, democratic, laissez-faire.
Right.
There's others, but we can use those three in this context.
You're trying to figure out like what's an appropriate level of communication here and like what's too much and what's too harsh and what's too this and what's too that. It's really not easy to communicate. When you like look at the bones of it,
I always say it's the hardest thing you'll ever do. It's what you're expected to do all the time, but you're never taught how. It's always assumed that we know how to communicate because it's the first thing we do. The first way we communicate when we're born is through haptics, the communicative use of touch. It's why golden hour exists. It's why the baby gets put on the mom's skin. It's why a mom's hug or hand on a baby's back can calm them down differently than other people's. It's because we communicate through the use of touch from day one. And we know a high five and a kiss on the lips or a kiss on the cheek or a hug or a slap on the butt or a punch to the face all communicate very different things. But regardless of how we communicate, I think one of the most important things we can remember is the context is important. So context is key. What is the appropriate communication for the situation or the relationship? It comes down to context. So what's your goal? What's your relationship like? We could say, when I ask students what type of leadership style, and I use the autocratic, democratic, laissez-faire styles for them. There's many out there, depending on what you're reading. People always think that democratic is the right answer because it sounds the best. Oh, well, here's what I think. What do you think? Let's work on this together. Okay, here's our decision. We made our decision together. Let's move forward. Sounds lovely. If you and I are in the middle of a war, we don't have time for us to be like, well, what do you think? Well, what do you think? Well, what do you think? I need someone to say, we're doing this, move out. Some situations, I don't want my emergency room doctor saying, well, let's take a group consensus. What do we think I should do on this next step, right? I want someone in the room to say, this is what we need to do. So yeah, are you able to apply the right type of leadership in the right moment? And depending on your role, you could be engaging in all three styles. Mm-hmm. So if I'm your manager, I may be a little bit more autocratic. I might say it's my way. Like, this is how we need to do this. And this is what I want you to do. Go ahead and do it for XYZ project. And then midway through the project, I might say like, okay, how do we think this is going? What do you think we should do next? Let's make this decision together on how to proceed. That's democratic. I'm taking that group consensus. And then sometimes maybe I see you flourishing in a role and you're saying, okay, how do you want me to proceed? And I'm hands off saying, I trust you. You do what you need to do. Hands off, little laissez-faire. I always tell my students kind of sounds like lazy. It's not lazy leadership, but it's just a hands-off approach, trusting your team members to do what they need to do and knowing that they can do it well. It really comes down to context and the situation that you're in and applying the right type of communication when. And you're right, it's not easy to do that all the time. That example we gave maybe is a little bit more clear cut in terms of management or leadership. When you're talking about your relationships with your husband or with your children or with your best friends, maybe it's a little bit more muddied. Like, what is the proper type of communication here? How do I assert my thoughts, or how aggressive do I get, or what is the right way to approach some of these situations that you find yourself in?
And when like you look at, like my example is like at work and school, I am one way. Mm-hmm. I am presenting myself in a manner that is professional and I'm on task. I'm watching every word I say and I'm being careful in the language I use. And then when I come home and I'm in the safe space of my husband and son, I feel like I don't need to check myself as much. Like I'm just kind of like, this is how I feel. And I don't really care how you feel. Right. I do need to get this message across and whatever. It depends on the environment. Like you're saying, context, professionally, personally, even with my romantic relationship and then with my friendships, that's a totally different communication experience too. Because what I'm comfortable telling my husband, I'm not going to feel comfortable telling a friend. Like, I really don't like the way you're doing this right now.
Right.
Probably would never feel comfortable enough to tell my friend.
Why not?
Well, I can use us as an example.
Yeah.
You always say that honesty is...
direct is kind.
Direct is kind. I just don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I feel like, I guess it depends on your delivery of a message.
Of course it does.
In my opinion, based on the friendships I have, I feel like there's certain things I can tell some friends or say, and there's others I don't, because I don't think that they will handle it the way...
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. And it's so interesting because I'm just thinking of all the ways I want to respond to this. And it's like taking me through every chapter of the interpersonal communication text I deliver in class. But a few things, and I hope I don't forget anything you just said, because I think it's all important and I want to go back to it all. You're totally right that the first thing I thought of was, it's the same way our kids act. They say that kids act like 700% times worse with their mothers or something. That's because they trust them. So it's actually, believe it or not, a compliment to us, but the behavior doesn't feel like that all the time, right? But the six elements of a satisfying relationship, like investment, intimacy, acceptance, trust, or self-disclosure, how you build trust is you self-disclose information about yourself, support, and commitment. And interpersonal relationships really are those people you're closest with, right? So your family, your intimate partners, and your friends. And theory says, whether we agree with this or not, theory says that really you can only have 5 strong interpersonal relationships at any given time. Because if you're contributing to those relationships fully in that way, they're your 5 closest. And it's hard to maintain more than 5 close relationships just from like an energy perspective. Now, we could say, like I'll use my girlfriends, for example. There's a large group of us that have been friends for, you know, 20, 25 years. Would lay down my life for any single one of them. But are we maintaining and sustaining strong interpersonal relationships every day? We all talk in a group chat every day, but am I closer to a few of them at different stages of our lives? Are we all close with them in different ways at different times? Absolutely. That's a human behavior, like a human condition, that it's hard to maintain more than that. So some of your friends you mentioned, some of them, maybe you feel comfortable doing that, or you feel like maybe you could if you needed to, and some you might not. Maybe you don't with any of them, and that's because you feel like it may not be received the same way. That's because our communication is transactional. So a transactional model of communication means there's a sender. So right now it's me sending you a message. You're the receiver. And I'm sending that message through a channel. And sometimes that channel is verbal communication like me and you, or it's mediated communication through a text message or our radio or our podcast platform, or it's written text in an email or in a text. And it goes through those channels and it's received through that channel. But as it goes through that, there's a bunch of noise. So when we talk about noise, we're not just talking about like the construction outside your window or your kids screaming on the phone. That is noise for sure. But there's physiological noise. You're stressed, you're angry, you're worried, you're really excited. You have a trip tomorrow and I'm trying to tell you about something that happened at work today. No, thank you, right? Like, we're distracted. For me, I'm hungry. Like, I'm like Betty White in the Snickers commercial. If I'm hungry, I'm hangry. I'm probably not paying attention to you, right? So we all have these things when we're tired, when we're irritated. That's all noise. And that impacts how we receive a message. It is amazing that we ever communicate effectively, because so much miscommunication happens because you never know what type of noise is happening for your receiver of your message. And based on your past experience, your beliefs, your opinions, your values, you are receiving a message differently than how the sender intended to send it.
1000% yes.
So we always have to understand the context we're sending in it. And that's why I say direct is kind, because if I can be as direct as I can with my message, I'm leaving less room for interpretation for you as a receiver. It's all about reciprocation, right? Reciprocity is like the most important thing we can do in our relationships. And that doesn't necessarily mean an eye for an eye, or you give what you take or whatever, but it does in theory. But it also means you mimic or model the behavior that you want sent back to you. So if you had an issue with me, for example, I would rather you directly talk to me about it. Uh-oh, the face. Then assume you know what it is I'm feeling or doing, because it's probably coming down to miscommunication. Like, I would say 99%, if not 100, but for the sake of not having the research done, I'll say 99% of all conflict comes down to miscommunication. That's in business, in personal,
absolutely,
and everything. One side, one party, does not fully understand the other party.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does come down to miscommunication. We're just not understanding one another, or we're not believing them, or whatever. And that causes conflict. And not all conflict is bad, right? Like, we're really uncomfortable as human beings with conflict. But conflict is just neutral. It's not positive or negative. It can be both, but it's how you communicate through conflict that makes it positive or negative. And a positive way to communicate through conflict is to keep it substantive, which means about the issue at hand, and not to make it personal. You always do this, or you never do this, because we're making these static evaluations about human beings. And as humans, we're not static. We don't stay the same, right? So maybe I show up late 2 times. This is a funny example because I am notoriously late. Let's say I show up late 2 times and we're working on a group project together, and you're talking about me to someone else, and you're saying like, well, Sarah's always late. Well, that's a static evaluation, because I'm not always late. Am I late every single day of my life? No. Was I late in 2 instances so you're fair to make that perception of me? Sure. But how do we keep our minds open to make sure that that like first or second impression doesn't color our whole picture of someone, right? We talk about this now in the stage of life we're in, that if someone knew me in high school, I would hate for them to be describing me to someone else. Not that I'm totally different, but I am different enough that like if you knew me 20 years ago, you don't really know me now unless we maintain some of that relationship. So those static evaluations, I think, can get in our way. I got off track there. But so I think why I say direct is kind is because I want that reciprocity to say like, okay, I just heard that whatever it is, like I'm upset because I think you're doing this. At least that gives our partner the opportunity to say, yeah, I am doing that. And then we can talk about whether you're upset and maybe we need some space or whatever. Or it allows me to say, oh my gosh, I think I need to provide a bit more context. Here's how I was feeling about it. And I'm sorry if I didn't communicate clearly about that. Or here's why I meant by that word or that language or why I did that action. So it's giving the opportunity to provide more context sometimes in those scenarios.
I want to talk about the types of listeners that we are, because I think that also plays into communication hugely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much a defensive listener.
Yeah.
And I know that about myself. In my relationships with everyone, mm-hmm. work, with friendships, my partner, I'm already on the defense before anyone has even finished saying what they're saying. And I truly don't know how to not be that way. Say if Daniel's trying to explain something to me, I'm already like heightened and ready to go with my response before he's even finished the thought. Because I'm defensively listening.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how to be any other way. Like, is this just who I am as a human?
No, it definitely is not. And that's something I tell students all the time as well, is being an ineffective communicator is not a life sentence. One of the main principles of interpersonal communication is that it can be learned. So we can improve. Like, we can always be improving and be more effective in our communication. And this is a great example. And it also reminded me what I meant to say in that last answer as well, which relates to this one, is another principle of interpersonal communication is that every message contains content and relational dimension to a message. So not only what we're saying, but how we're saying it. And then more so, another layer to that is who we're saying it to. So I use the silly example often that, like, I can tell you that I love you, and I can tell my kids that I love them, and I can tell my husband I love him, and I can tell the pizza guy who delivered me pizza that I love him, and I can tell the person on the street who gave me directions when I'm lost, like, thank you, I love you. But I would hope, although I'm using that same word, that same language, that the relationship dimension is understood. I don't love you like I love Patrick, and I don't love Patrick like I love the pizza guy. And there's kind of a hierarchy there, although we don't always say mm-hmm. that. But, you know, we know what we mean. Hopefully we all know. And when we don't know, when that's not understood, that's when miscommunication mm-hmm. happens. I'm in trouble if the pizza guy thinks I love him like I love Patrick, right? Like, that's leading us to some miscommunication and some misunderstanding there.
Yeah, we don't want to get in a baby reindeer situation here.
Wait, I don't get it.
The baby reindeer show on Netflix?
Oh, I don't think I
saw. About like the stalker?
Oh, I didn't watch it. Oh, I'm scared. So see, that leads to miscommunication. So every message we says, and we know as human beings that oftentimes, Jess, we actually trust the relational dimension. We trust what we're saying, the nonverbal package we're sending a message in, over the verbal message we're sending. So if I walked in here today and you said, Sarah, how's your day? And I said, it's good. Today's like the best day of my life. I'm having a great day. What would you think? If I said it just like that, today's great. It's the best day of my life. Having a wonderful day.
You're being sarcastic and your day is absolutely miserable.
If you had to put like $10 down on she's having a good day, she's having a bad day, you're picking bad day.
100%.
Although my word said I'm having a great day, the tone I said it in is telling you that it's the complete opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that proves that if it comes down to how we're saying something or the way in which we're saying it, we're always believing the way in which we're saying it. It's why there's conflict. And women, this isn't my own thought, this is what research shows. Stereotypically, this doesn't mean all women or all men, but stereotypically, women are socialized to be relational communicators. So we focus more on that. We focus more on the package messages are being sent in. And men from a really early age are socialized to be action-oriented communicators, instrumental communicators. They communicate for action to get something done, right? I've said this before, but that's true for like the toys we're given when we're young. My toys, I had to make a relationship with my Barbie dolls for them to make sense. But my brothers were probably using like remote controls. They were actively using their toys. You learn to communicate the same way. It's why our husbands would hang out and like go for a beer and watch a game. They're still probably talking, but it's over some sort of activity where you and I would sit on this couch for hours and just talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens with that sometimes, two reasons, and we'll go back to your defensive listening point, is that oftentimes what happens there is sometimes we become literal listeners. And if you're being a literal listener, it means you're only listening to the verbal message that's being sent and you're ignoring the nonverbal message. And we get upset at that sometimes. If I say, I'm fine, and then our partners say, okay, great. And then hours later, we're like, I can't believe you didn't know I wasn't okay. And they're like, but you said you were fine. We're like, but I said I was fine. You should have known I meant that wasn't
fine. By the tone.
By the tone. But we said we were fine, right? So that message we're sending can get convoluted if we're not being direct with it. So we really do have to pay attention to the verbal and nonverbal delivery of our messages. So defensive listening, Jess, to go back to that, you 100% are a defensive listener. We all are at certain points. And what that means is that the definition for people listening is that a defensive listener means that you're looking for an insult or criticism where there was none intended. So what happens there, Jess, is it's not a life sentence. You can change that. That doesn't mean you're going to be like that all the time. It means that you're going to start to participate in some perception checking and you're going to start to use some dual perspective, which means you're going to consider the situation from your lens and from your communication partner's lenses as she rolls her eyes. So is Daniel saying, is he really like passively aggressively criticizing you? Probably not, because he's probably going to tell you that just to your face at this point, right? Mm-hmm. So his message, he might be really honest in what he's saying. There's usually a reason why we're being defensive though. And it usually leads, I know you're going to hate this next sentence, but it usually means that you have to take some time to kind of step back and critically reflect on 100%. What's causing that defensive reaction.
I know.
Usually it's like a past experience or a past trauma. When I say trauma, I don't mean to minimize that, but I don't necessarily mean like a traumatic event, but some sort of negative communication experience that happened in the past. Or it's often an insecurity of ours. So women often tend to feel this at work sometimes because we may feel, or we've been socialized to believe that we're like less than in some of these business or situations. And we can become defensive listeners hearing criticism where there's none intended. Or perhaps there's a bit of like a rocky relationship so that you tend to be more of a defensive listener with that person. Or if you have a history of not being clear or effective in your communication with those people, you tend to become a defensive listener. Or you might be cranky or stressed or worried and you become a defensive listener.
Right.
An example I can give to kind of color it for people is that, and I've said this before, but I was nursing the twins. It was a high stress situation. They were a few weeks old. I felt so responsible for like their health and growth as like a nursing mom of twins. I was feeding them what felt like every damn second of every damn day. Patrick was always there to help. I was pumping. I was nursing. He was passing me. I was tandem nursing them at the same time. And one baby one night would not sleep. It was like 3 a.m. And Patrick so innocently says, maybe he's hungry. And in my head, I swear to you, he said, you're not feeding them enough.
Right.
But that's not what he said. And that's not what he meant. But I was being a defensive listener because I was stressed and at my tipping point and probably filled with anxiety at the time. And I heard, you're not feeding him enough. And I lost my shit. And he just looked at me like a deer in a headlight and was like, what is happening?
What did I just do?
He was sleep deprived too. Like, didn't I just say maybe he's hungry? That's all I said. But you mean I'm not feeding them enough? He was like, no, I absolutely don't mean that. I do not mean that. I just meant maybe he's hungry again. But because of the situation I was in, that stress and pressure, I heard something different. So oftentimes when that happens, it actually is like an us problem and not a them problem. So if we're being defensive listeners, there's probably a deeper reason why we're doing that.
Right. I think it comes down to their communication as well, though. If I'm being a defensive listener, is it because your delivery is making me feel that way?
Well, two things. I get what you're saying.
I'm not saying this is the situation.
No, I understand. I think you're right. And that's why I come back to direct is kind, because we can be as direct as we can. Then we can realize that we can trust the fact more that we're being direct and we're leading with kindness in what we do. But the other thing is a fallacy of interpersonal relationships. And I'll say like communication equals relationships. Relationships equal communication. You cannot have one without the other. I, thou, I, you, I, it. So like machine-like communication, like that's the I, it spectrum. Everything's on a continuum. I, you is like you're friendly, they're friends, you're acquaintances. You see each other, you might even hang out, but you're kind of like not that level, not the deepest level. And then that I, thou relationship is those like closest people to you, those friends, family, intimate people. So you're right in the sense that can we be more clear as a sender in communication to kind of prevent that? For sure. But one of the biggest fallacies in interpersonal communication is that we're responsible for other people's feelings and we're not. So being responsible for others, that's a fallacy. Like we actually are not responsible for others. So I hate to say it, but Daniel is actually not responsible for your reaction to what he communicates. He is responsible for trying to choose like the most effective way to communicate in your relationship. But he's not responsible for how you react to it. We are responsible for our own,
for sure,
communication and our own reactions to things. So that can be hard, especially if we're in caretaking roles that we're used to kind of being responsible, or we want to feel like we're responsible for other people. The whole idea of like gaslighting is making other people kind of feel responsible sometimes. Yes. That toxicity in relationships usually is like, you did this and you made me feel this way. And it's like the lack of responsibility for our own behavior, our own emotion. So that's when that can get that kind of negative connotation to it. But yeah, we all have a responsibility to try to communicate as effectively as we can. But knowing if you're having these like defensive listening experiences, that is probably something that you have to look inward on. Like, for when sure. does it happen? Who does it happen with? What topics does it happen over?
And I think too, I've done a few things over the years, like as I've learned in different roles and just in education and different things, that like using I statements, like owning how you are feeling.
Yes, very good.
How can you get in trouble for that? In any scenario, like this is how I'm feeling. I feel this way because I da 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 da. And I've worked on those statements in different scenarios. But it's when we're placing blame of like, you made me feel this way when you did this, right? As opposed to, I felt this way because I experienced da 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 da.
Exactly. And that's so important. So what Jess just explained is I versus you language. So how you communicate in a sentence really matters. Like, I feel this way when we're experiencing A, B, and C. It's not, you make me feel this way, because you're responsible for your feelings. So like, I feel disappointed when I get home and I'm expected to do all of these things after a long day. Not, you make me feel this way. That's taking responsibility so that our partners, and when I say partner, I mean communicative partners. It could be your colleague or your friend or whatever, your parent, so that they have an opportunity to say, oh my gosh, like I didn't know you felt that way, right? So I talk a lot about confirming and disconfirming climates. And this is especially true in workplaces. And I think it's something we all should be considering way more often than we do. But you hear a lot about workplace culture, work culture. They have a good culture there. It's a lot in sports too. We talk about that. Like, that's a good culture of that team or whatever. But really what we're talking about is the climate. And when we create climates in our communities often, and we do that through our communication and relationship building, and climates, positive or negative, and they can kind of go back and forth on that scale often, but talk about that, like positive work climates. What's happening is we're creating a confirming climate, and we're creating a confirming or disconfirming climate by a few ways. And there's three steps to creating a confirming climate. You acknowledge, you recognize, and you endorse. So the first level of a confirming climate is you're recognizing. That can be a basic as recognizing a human's existence. They walk into the office and you say hello. Or they're back after a vacation and you say, hey, welcome back. How was your trip? Right? You're just recognizing the person's existence. You're saying hi when you walk into a party. If you're an educator, you're saying, hey, Jess, when you walk into the classroom, even if it's late, right? Like, you're recognizing they exist. The next level of confirmation is acknowledgement. And it's acknowledging the person's values and opinions and ideas. It doesn't necessarily mean you always agree with them, but it's me saying like, Jess, I totally get what you're saying there. Like, that's a great point of view. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I understand that that's how you feel. And like, let's work on this. So you're acknowledging that that's a real way that someone's feeling or thinking or believing or et cetera. And then the third level and the greatest level of confirmation is endorsement. And that's just the greatest level of support, right? You support them. You're fully supporting or endorsing what they're doing. This could be as simple as like laughing at your partner's jokes. Mm. Jess, I always use the example in my class about your wedding. Do you remember when I was emceeing your wedding and I said a joke at the start? I don't remember what the joke was. I said it. People really didn't get it. So no one laughed. Yeah. But Pat laughed and he laughed like the loudest I've ever heard him laugh in my life. But no one else laughed. And then everyone laughed when they realized it was my husband laughing. Yeah. Right? So it was funny in the end. And I use that example because I know what he was doing. He was trying to provide a confirming climate. Mm-hmm, he was endorsing the greatest form of confirmation he could give me was laughing at that joke. He probably heard it when I was practicing or whatever. He knew it was coming. He was ready for it. He wanted to support me. And that was the greatest form of support he could have gave. So I tell that all the time in class. Like, it was so embarrassing, but so funny, guys, because no one else laughed, but he was trying to laugh to make me feel better, right? That level of support. So in our relationships, maybe your partner smokes and you don't love that about them. So you're not endorsing it. You're not buying them cigarettes and saying, why don't you go for a smoke, honey? You're not doing that, right? That greatest level of support. And that's okay. Maybe you're still recognizing and acknowledging that this is something about them. And in spite of that, you're going to support what you can, right? You're not trying to change them. You're not trying to necessarily fix them in a way, but you're not supporting it either. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you're creating a disconfirming climate, so to speak. But if you're never recognizing or acknowledging or endorsing what your partner is doing, your friend, your colleague, your whatever, communicative partner, that's when you can lead to disconfirming climates. So if you're never recognizing them, if you're never acknowledging the work they're doing, if you're never valuing or supporting their ideas or their opinions or their values or them as human beings, that leads to disconfirming climates. And that can be a really, really negative, toxic place to be, especially in our intimate relationships. friendships for sure, and our workplaces. Like research shows that if you're providing a disconfirming climate in your workplace, or your workplace climate is negative from your employees' perspective, they're going to be underproducing. They're not going to be as productive.
Absolutely.
And they're also not going to be as loyal. You're going to have higher turnover. It's really an economic issue when it comes to business.
And it's so interesting that you say this because it all ties in no matter how old we are, who we're communicating to, whether it's our kids, our parents, our friends. When I work with toddlers, I talk to parents about communicating with their children, with their toddlers, with their preschoolers, school-aged kids, and really trying to acknowledge them. Because I often say that we don't give kids enough credit. So like use the example of going to bed, for instance. If, you know, we say it's time to put the Lego away and go to bed, and then you might get left with a circumstance where the child is like, we know what that looks like, throwing the Lego or being upset or I don't want to. So it's a matter of acknowledging how they're feeling.
Right. Exactly.
I see that you're upset. You know what? I can tell because when I took the Lego away, you got angry. That made you right. upset. And then kind of acknowledging, like setting the limit of the Lego's going away right now. We can have the Lego again tomorrow. We do this stuff with our kids all the time.
Yes. Or we should be.
I hear you're upset or like, you know, you experienced that at school. That must have been so hard. But it's so interesting because with Daniel as a grown adult, I'm not sure if I give him that level of support because I'm like, oh.
Or acknowledgement.
Or acknowledgement because it's like, you've got this. Like you're an adult. But like with Logan, I feel like I need to give you these skills and give you this confirming message because I'm not sure otherwise if you would get it. But it's the same situation.
Anchored Ideas is Kate Breton's leading marketing and communications agency. Known for their heart and hype, big dreams for Cape Breton Unimogi fuel their creativity. Here, there is no divide between business and community. Your neighbors and friends may very well also be your family. And when local businesses are doing well, we're all rising together.
For these reasons and more, when the team at Anchored Ideas work with a client, it's personal. They're proud to be there for the big wins, the hurdles, and all the moments in between. They help you build your brand, define your difference, and connect you with those who matter.
This signature heart and hype is the core of everything they do at Anchored Ideas. And we know firsthand that this team of powerhouse professionals are exactly who you need to speak to when trying to bring your vision to life.
It is the same. And what happens, we do it with our kids because we want to model that behavior for them so that they can do it back to us, right? And we don't always do that with adults because we assume we know better, but we really don't.
Right.
And that's why I say direct is kind or reciprocity is so important because you really do want to mimic or model the behavior, the communication behavior that you want back. You want to give that to your communicative partners, right? And that's a really great example. That's the other one I give in class is when my kids come to me at 2 a.m. and say, Mom, I'm scared there's a monster under my bed. I want to say, no, there isn't.
No, there's no such thing.
Because I know there isn't, right? To me, that monster is not real.
Right.
To them, it is very real in the moment. So I have two choices. And what happens is that if you are never confirmed as a child, you are most likely, I want to say insecure, but that's not necessarily the word I mean. You're probably an emotionally unavailable adult, right? And we all have levels of that. And it's probably because your emotions weren't recognized or acknowledged as a kid. It's the same way, you know, when we fall. Okay, I'll go to that example next. But yes, so the monster under the bed. No, there's not. It's 2 a.m. I'm tired. I want to say, there's no monster under your bed. Go back to bed, right? But that's easy for me, but for them, they're still really experiencing a very real experience for them. They're really scared. They feel fear, right? Mm-hmm. So to recognize it, I would say, you think there's a monster under your bed? That must be so scary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To acknowledge it, I would say, buddy, I understand your fear and that is scary to wake up in the middle of the night with that, but I don't think there's a monster under your bed. So let's go check together. Mm-hmm. And then to endorse or support him, it's not saying support in that situation wouldn't be like, oh, you're right. There might be a monster under your bed because that's how you feel. That's what you think.
Right.
But it's supporting the fact that he feels that way and offering support. So it's saying, buddy, there's no monster under your bed. I'm so confident. I'm going to go check myself and make sure so that you feel safe.
Right.
So let's go check together or you can wait here and I'll go check. It's up to you. And then we go in and we look under the bed. See, there's no monster under your bed, but I know that that must have been scary. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling now, right? Easy to say when it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon and not 2 a.m.
Right.
But it is important to think about that because your kid is really experiencing that, right? It's the same way, and I know our generation was raised like this, maybe not blanket statement everybody, but most of us, because we just want our kids to feel okay. And we really try to insulate them from feelings, negative feelings that we would classify as negative feelings. I would argue that no feelings are overly negative, depending on how we're communicating or managing them moving forward. But it's important to feel sadness and it's important to feel fear and guilt. You know, you have to go through that range. So when our kids fall or scrape their knees, what's one of the first things we tend to say or that people tended to say before? It's like, you're fine. You're okay. We're telling them, right? You're okay. You're fine.
Who are we to say?
Internally, they're not feeling okay.
No. And how are we to determine that? We don't, like, we're not in their bodies.
And when we say that, we're disconfirming.
Absolutely.
The very real experience they're having, which is feelings of probably embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is pain, you know, whatever it is. Maybe they are fine, but that's not up for us to say.
Right.
So what happens is we say that to kids when they fall down or get hurt or experience something uncomfortable for the first like 10 years of their lives. And then they come home from school when they're 13 and we say, how's your day? And they say, it was fine. And we get mad at that. But that's the only language we've taught them up until this point. It's fine. You're fine. It's okay. Regardless if it was good or bad, you're fine. Regardless if you're experiencing pain or whatever, it's fine. You're fine. So instead, and like one thing I do, and we've talked about this before, I'm not saying this is the only thing to do, but I find it helpful and it's been effective with my kids is when they fall or scrape their knee, I do want to say, you're okay, you're okay, you're fine. I stop myself or I catch myself and I started to say, did you get hurt or did you get a fright? Because I'm trying to give them language. Like, did you get hurt? And if so, let's talk about what part of your body hurts and what it feels like. Or did you get a fright? Are you embarrassed? Did you slip? Did you get scared? Are you feeling, you know, shame? What is it? And then we can talk about how to manage those feelings. I'm not taking it away from you because you feel it and you're going to feel it. And you need to learn how to manage those feelings because when you're 16, you're going to be embarrassed about something. And I want you to be able to say like, I'm embarrassed and this sucks, but I know it'll get better. Like I'm not going to feel this way forever because I didn't feel that way forever when I was 7, you know? So being able to give them some more language around it, I think is super duper important. And the only way we give our kids that language is by trying to model it ourselves.
For sure.
So I try to explain my feelings a lot too, like label them. Like I'm feeling, honey, I'm feeling upset or I'm feeling frustrated because of this and I need a minute and it's okay. And we're gonna, and then sometimes Bo lately will say like, are you happy? And I have to remind himself like, buddy, I am happy, but you're also not responsible for my happiness.
Right.
Like what you do or do not do does not impact how I feel toward you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the child. I'm the adult.
Yeah.
If I'm happy or not happy, that's not on you. You're not responsible for that, right? So it is a fine line, but I think it is really giving our kids the language that we want to talk about in that way.
And then sometimes it's funny because the other day we were in the car and Logan had just ate and then he had a snack. Like it was very much like, the kid, there's no way the kid could be hungry, right?
Right, right.
In my head, he's bored. So we were driving along and he was bored. So he's like, I'm hungry. And I'm like, buddy, you're not hungry. You just ate whatever you're bored. And he's like, mom, he's like, you are not in my body. You do not know if I'm hungry or not.
Right.
And so like, I've used all this language his whole life and he's thrown it back on me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're right, buddy. I was like, you're right, buddy. I don't know. I'm not in your body. I was just making an assumption because you just literally ate.
Right. I thought you'd be full.
Like, you know.
And that's the thing, right? Like kids are always listening. So over 53% of our days are spent listening. And it's one of the skills that we are not taught enough about and that we're not taught enough about as adults to contribute to like productive environments that we're in. And really a skill, and it is a skill to be learned and improved upon, is active listening. How to be an active listener. We have a lot of distractions in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
I say, if you're not exhausted at the end of a day, you have not been listening. Because if you are an active listener, that will take more energy than if you're the loudest speaker in the room.
Right.
And if you are the loudest speaker in the room, you probably aren't being an active listener. Because if you're there's nothing wrong with speaking and verbally contributing your ideas. I love that. But if you're not also actively listening to the people you're in a group with, then there's probably a disconnect there somewhere. So over 53% of our days are spent listening or pretending to listen, pseudo listening, as many of my students do. And there's different forms of listening. We talked about literal, we talked about defensive. There's ambushing, like if you find like a fault in what someone said and you use it against them, like lawyers should be really good at ambushing, right? Like that's the art of it. Finding weakness in their statement and what they're saying and using it against them.
multitasking. Like, we're trying to do so many things. And often we say, like, I'm a great multitasker. Well, that's great, but that means you're a bad listener. Because if you're multitasking while you're listening, you're not actively listening. You should be practicing floor, like, so F-E-L-O-R. You're facing your partner. You have open posture. You're making eye contact. You're slightly leaning forward, not too much to make it awkward. But if I was to say, like, did you hear? You would just naturally lean forward
right,
a little bit.
Right.
When we're about to hear something exciting, we do that. And that's how we show engagement to our communicating partner. And you relax. Like, you need to be able to relax to listen well. And if you're stressed or you're anxious or you're high strung over something, you're probably not being a very great listener in that moment. And with kids, it's especially important, I think, to remember, and I'm not an expert in kids in general, but kids are always listening. So I am an expert in terms of, like, our building our relationships and communication. And I can tell you it happens when we're very young and it takes years to undo what has been done. So right now as adults, we're trying, like, you're a defensive listener, Jess, maybe. And so am I sometimes because of whatever happened when you were 10, let's say. I don't know if that's true, but let's just say that there's probably been years of experiences where you maybe needed to be a defensive listener. I'm not assuming that's what's going on here, but it could be. But that's why it's so, that's why you're saying, like, well, this is just who I am, because it has been the most of your life that way. But maybe you're in an environment now where you don't have to be that way, but it's really hard to undo years of a habit, right? We know that. And that communicative behavior mm-hmm. can be considered habitual. You know, same as, like, conflict. We have conflict rituals. You might do the exact same thing in every conflict. That's your conflict ritual. Maybe you slam a door. Maybe you go quiet for a few days. Maybe you turn off all your lights and go to bed in a dark room. I don't know, but we all have these different ways we participate in conflict. So kids, they listen all the time. And I think sometimes as parents, we can assume our kids aren't listening because they're young and busy, but I'm telling you right now, they're always listening. So the words that you're choosing to talk about other people, to talk about yourself, talk about your body, talk about other people's bodies, they are listening to that. And they are just building up their language bank. So
right.
like those word banks that they have mm-hmm. are coming from you, are coming from your friends, are coming from their friends, from their social circles. By the time we're 7, our biggest influencers are our family, our social, like our friend
mm-hmm.
group,
mm-hmm.
and media. 7. You control 1/3 of that. Like, you don't control who they're talking to at school.
No pressure though.
Yeah, no pressure. I know. And media, like, that there's a lot of influence there,
oh
right?
My God,
it's
yeah.
why my kids think my favorite color is pink because media
right.
has told them that girls are pink.
Mm-hmm.
I've done nothing the last 6 years but tell them that pink is not my favorite color,
right?
Right. But that joke goes to prove that, like, that's how strong an influence.
And it doesn't
those
even have to be
influences
like
are.
Media. Like, if we think of the TV, it's
oh,
at
it's
Walmart.
Everything. Oh, no. Yeah,
like,
media
there's
means
a boys
like,
section yeah. and a girls section.
The advertisement on the billboard, the aisles at a shopping store. Yeah,
exactly.
It's everywhere. So your kids are listening. So I think it's really important. Like, if you're describing your body in a certain way, they're
yeah,
listening.
100%.
They're using that language in some way. They're looking at themselves the same way. Like, you are a mirror for them. You know, how you talk about people, how you talk about certain environments, like, all of those things are contributing to their perceptions and how they're learning how to communicate as well.
For sure. We have a few questions from listeners. So let's ask a couple of those. They're all very different because, like, communication, it's very vast. One question, which I think would relate to a lot of people, is, do you have any tips on fighting anxiety around public speaking?
Oh gosh, so many.
I know. Give us
so many.
Give us top three.
Okay. I think the number one thing to remember when you're public speaking is that the audience wants you to succeed.
Right.
We think the audience wants us to fail. That is not true. So you really have to shift your mindset there. The audience wants you to do well. You know yourself, if you're watching someone else public speak, when they mess up or make a mistake, you feel that
oh,
secondhand
100%.
Embarrassment. Like, it's the worst. They don't want to feel that way.
No.
And to be honest, in this day and age, like, half of them probably aren't paying attention to you anyway.
Yeah,
so, like,
true.
Take the pressure off yourself. But the ones who are paying attention, they want you to succeed. They want you to do well. They are your friends. Even if they're not your friends.
Yeah.
They're complete strangers.
Yeah.
They are your friends. So I think that's number one. The audience wants you to do well. Number two is recognizing that nervousness or apprehension is normal.
Mm-hmm.
So communication apprehension, that nervousness you feel, it could be trait or state. So if you're a little bit more shyer, or introverted as a human being, if like meeting new people makes you nervous, as well as public speaking, you probably have trait apprehension. You're nervous communicating in general. State communication apprehension, every single one of us feel. I've been doing it and teaching it for almost 2 decades, and I still get nervous public speaking. And the minute I stop getting nervous is the minute I'll stop public speaking, because it means you care.
Absolutely. Right?
So there's different levels though. Like some of us have such high apprehension that we can't physically speak in public. Like it totally knocks us out. We can't do it. And some of us can manage it. So the second tip is that knowing that nervousness is normal, and then doing a little check-in with yourself to see how your apprehension manifests itself. What symptoms are you experiencing when you get nervous? That will help you manage them. So for me, for example, I know that I fidget. Like if I'm going to go into an interview, I'm not wearing bracelets because I will fidget with them the entire time.
Right.
I'm not holding a pen in my hand because I'm likely to click it. I have students who do speeches clicking their pens, and afterwards I'll say, that was great, but try not to click your pen, and they'll fight with me. I didn't click my pen. Like you totally don't know you're doing it, right? Or playing with their hair, or if you run warm when you're nervous, dress in layers so that you can prevent that. Some people get feelings of like having to use the bathroom. Go use the bathroom before you speak. So there's ways that you can manage your anxiety. A lot of it's physiological. You will never get rid of it all, but you will manage it and know that it's normal. Okay, my heart's racing a little bit. I'm starting to feel a little flushed. I'm nervous.
Hands.
I know I'm nervous. Why am I nervous? Because I want to do well. Well, I'm going to do well. My audience wants me to succeed. So those are two things that I think would be really helpful. The third thing really is understanding structure and organization and knowing your content well. So if this was a class, I would be telling you to like use the pick method. So pick a topic that you're passionate about or interested in or knowledgeable about or that you care about, because if you're doing that, then it will alleviate some worries, right? If you asked me to get out and talk about communication, I would do it with my eyes closed. I'd be nervous, but I would do it. If you got up and asked me to talk about like space innovation, well, that's, I'm going to like fumble my way through that because I don't know the content well. I could probably do it if I practiced enough, but I don't, I'm not passionate about it. It would feel weird. So picking something you're knowledgeable about, but obviously if you're asking this question, it probably means you're speaking about something that you work within. And we're not always passionate about work topics, but there's probably something you can be passionate about within that. And then knowing your organization and practice makes perfect. And it's not about memorization. I don't want you to memorize a speech. I don't think that lends itself to dynamic speaking, but I think you want to practice enough to know that what are your three main points, right? You have your introduction, you're going to get your audience's attention, you're going to introduce yourself, you're going to introduce your topic. Probably going to tell us your thesis statement. Like, what are you talking about? Why are you talking about it? And then you're going to support that with three main points. What three main points are you going to tell me? Today I'm going to talk to you about A, B, and C. The body of your speech becomes A, B, and C. You're going to go from one point to the other and transition to them as it makes sense. And you're going to support each point with three more points, supportive points. And then you're going to conclude, which is just the reflection of your introduction. You're going to reiterate or restate what you just talked about and why it's important. You're going to end it with some sort of clincher. Maybe it's like a call to action. Maybe it's visit our website. Maybe it's sign up here. Maybe it's visit me at whatever. And maybe it's go plant a tree. I don't know, depending on the topic. And then you're going to thank them for their attention in the day. And knowing kind of that loose structure, and depending on your speech, if it's a wedding speech, you're not following that same.
Right.
That's a social speech. It's light. It's quick. It's, you know, celebrating a happy occasion. It follows a similar structure, but a little bit different. But just knowing, having yourself or your thoughts organized and giving yourself enough time to prepare for that. Now, if you're speaking impromptu, which is, you know, very little time to prepare on plan speaking, it's just following the same things like understanding nervousness is normal, having a main idea or point that you're trying to get across, reiterating and supporting that point in some way, not necessarily in the structure I just mentioned, being able to like mobilize your knowledge. So if you're knowledge sharing on some topic, just being able to be like clear and concise and kind of open to that. I really do think they say, and I don't know if this is entirely true, but I think it might even be like a Jerry Seinfeld joke or quote, but they do say that like people's second fear in life is dying and their very first fear is public speaking.
Wow.
So people would rather like at a funeral, you'd rather be the person in the coffin than at the podium doing the eulogy. Like that is wild to me, right? And it comes down to we do not like to be judged as human beings. So we do not like to be looked at as human beings. And when we're public speaking, people are looking at us and we feel like they're judging us and we hate that. We hate it. We're so uncomfortable with that. So just remind yourself, like, yeah, they're looking at you, but they're not judging you. They're not there to for you to fail. They're not rooting for you to do bad. They're actually doing the opposite. And if you need like a tangible takeaway, it's if you have trouble making eye contact, never look at your audience eyes. Just look right at their forehead. Yeah. If you're looking at their forehead, it looks like you're looking in their eyes, but you're not. They don't know that. Don't apologize. Like, people don't know what you have prepared. So you don't need to say like, oh, sorry, forgot I just messed up or I forgot to say this. Right. They don't know that. Just continue on. You're leading it, right? Be confident in that. And then at the end, this is just my own pet peeve, but never say like, that's it. Or I'm done. Yeah. Just say thank you. Like, we know how to clap. Yeah. Or like, great, thanks for having me today.
Yeah.
And pause, right? And silence is your friend. So we feel like we need to fill in the silence with ums or ahs or oohs or whatever. Because we don't like the quiet. Like, we just sat here in a minute. Like, this is a second of silence.
Make it stop.
Yeah, see, like, you get uncomfortable. But really, silence is fine. So if you're like transitioning or you lost your point, if I just, okay, I'm gonna, like, you can stop for a second. It feels like a lifetime to you as a speaker, but it's a blip for the audience. It's a second. Don't fill that in with, because that lends itself to your credibility, right? It decreases your credibility as a speaker. We all do it, but try to minimize those vocal fillers as much as you can.
Reminds me of my wedding day. Like, walking down the aisle was the worst. Yeah. Everyone's staring at you at the same time. It's awful.
Yeah, it is. We don't like that. It's we do not like to be looked at.
I did not anticipate that.
Yeah.
I started walking down and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, stop looking at me.
What would you rather, Jess? Like, would you rather speak in front of, like, 1,000 people you don't know or 20 people you know?
1,000 people I don't know.
Me too. I'm the same way. I would 100%. Take 1,000 people I don't know over the 20 people I know every time.
Thanks for that. One other question, which again, I think this is probably another one that a lot of people are wondering the same thing. How do I get doctors to take me seriously and stop seeing me as an overreactive mom?
I don't have enough time on this podcast.
I know.
This is such an important question. I really think this comes down to direct as kind and being confident in yourself and trusting your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what happens in healthcare professions, especially if you live in a place like we live where like the system is overloaded, what's happening, well, in any situation in healthcare, there's a power dynamic, right? So there's like 7 sources of power in interpersonal communication. There's also nonverbal forms of communication. So I'll start with that. So one of the nonverbal forms of communication is chronemics. And chronemics is the communicative use of time. And we communicate a lot through time, right? I have time for you. I don't have time for that. Like that signals like what we value, what we have importance on. But also spending time with people, how much time, if you arrive early, it's like a sign of respect maybe, or if you show up too late, maybe it's a sign of disrespect, or we all have our iterations of what that means. And it means different things to different people, especially in different cultures, right? In some cultures, like in North American or Western culture, time kind of controls us in that way. In other cultures though, time is insignificant in terms of like arriving on time or being late or whatever. That doesn't exist. But here, especially in our medical system, chronemics, like we demonstrate power through the use of time. So if you're 15 minutes late for your doctor's appointment, they aren't waiting for you because your time isn't as valuable as their time in the system. You need them. They don't need you, right? If they're 15 minutes late to see you, well, you're waiting. You're waiting hours to see them because you need them more, right? So we go into these situations with that in mind. Like, we know that their time is valuable and we have little time with them. And there's a lot of pressure to get through those messages in that short amount of time sometimes. And that's no fault of the provider necessarily. I mean, certain situations it might be, but it's more of a systemic thing. The other thing that's at play is that there's different sources of power in interpersonal relationships. And one of those forms of power is expertise power. And if you are the expert, like if I'm taking my car to Kia or I'm taking my computer to the tech guy, they have the power. They're telling me what's wrong and how to fix it and what it's going to cost. And because I'm not as knowledgeable in those areas, I have very little power to argue with that, right? And we feel like that's the same way in a medical environment. Like, they have the knowledge, they have the training, they have the expertise power, and we're there to listen to them and follow their guidelines. I think what we forget sometimes is that they're humans too. And like, humans cause error. You trust your medical provider and they're they only have what they know to go off of, right? So they have different cases to compare it to, or they have different comparators and, you know, your age grouping or whatever it is. They're looking at your symptoms at the time. They're making the most educated call that they can. And that's it. If you feel in your gut that that's not right, Jill has talked about this with us before, like you have to communicate mm-hmm. what's on your mind, right? If you're like Jill said, if you're thinking it's cancer and I'm not thinking it's cancer, mm-hmm. well, I'm not addressing that concern for you because you're not bringing it up, mm-hmm. but it's not even on my radar,
right.
but it's all you can think about, right? So that's where that direct is kind comes in again, right? Like I'm here, I'm worried it's this, I feel this way, I have a strong feeling, it's impacting my well-being, you know? So trying to be as communicative as possible or clear in that. But there's a few things working against us, especially as moms, and there is a gendered component to communication. We expect certain types of communication from certain people. It's no fault of providers, but in various situations, I will be treated differently than my husband, even if we're saying the exact same thing. And it's because we have preconceived notions or perceptions of how we expect people to communicate. And if Pat and I are communicating the same way, I'm being labeled one way and he's being labeled the other way. And it's just the way
he's
it works.
He's being labeled the great dad
right.
that took the kid to the doctor's appointment.
Right.
Like, oh my goodness.
Right.
And we're being labeled as the like anxious ridden mom who is overthinking.
Right. And we go back to that transactional model of communication. If you're sending a message and it's being received as you're the anxious mom or you're just, you know, you're worried over nothing or you're worried too much or, you know, you're just being anxious and they're not taking you seriously. It's easy to say like, get a second opinion, but in our system, that's not as easy. We're lucky if we have a doctor.
Right.
You don't really have access to that necessarily. So what has to happen is clear communication. And sometimes that means setting boundaries, but other times it just means really calling it for what it is.
I don't feel like it'll be uncomfortable.
Yeah. And it'll be uncomfortable, but it's to say, if it's for you or your child, like it's saying, okay, I followed your advice or we've gone through your plan. We've done it for X amount of time. I don't see results or my child's still not feeling better. I know my child. This isn't their
baseline.
This isn't their normal. This is odd for them. They're pretty clear in their communication. We've tried different things, et cetera. We need to do something different. And maybe it's asking for the test. Can we do this?
Can I get a referral to a pediatrician?
Can I get a referral to this? I understand the system is overloaded. I'm not trying to waste anyone's time. And maybe it's just putting that all out there. I know the system's overloaded. I'm not trying to waste any time. I'm not trying to get tests that are unnecessary. But at this point in time in our situation, I feel this is necessary. And maybe it means if you're in a partnership and your partner can both be there and it's a united front. I mean, it sucks that that has to happen, but maybe that adds a different level of seriousness to it as well. Saying like, we are concerned. We feel like this is impacting our quality of life. We feel like XYZ needs to be done, or we would like to see XYZ next,
yep.
or can we get another round of blood work, or can we order that test just to be sure? Because I don't feel like we're being listened to, or I don't feel like we're being cared for properly, or I feel like we're missing something here. And the importance of what we spoke about before, I think, is a highlight in this situation as well. It's not about you. You're wrong, or you're making the wrong call, or you weren't treating us properly, because we're going to assume that our healthcare professionals have our best interest at heart, right? We're going to assume that they're making these decisions with the information that they have, based on the comparators that they have, based on the numbers that they have, based on the data that they have, right? And that's their jobs. That's how they do their jobs. That's why they're good at their jobs. But sometimes we fall outside of that data. So again, it's not attacking the person, but it's just the substantive issue. So saying, look, like I understand that this makes sense in like the theory of this age group or this situation mm-hmm. or whatever, but I just feel like we're falling outside of this. So like, I know you're doing your best, but for my peace of mind or our quality of life, I think we need to do mm-hmm. XYZ, or is there anything else we can do? Maybe not assuming what it is that needs to be done.
And I think it's okay to say, like I was saying before, I don't feel understood.
Yes.
I feel like I am being understood as an over sensitive mom.
Right.
But in actuality,
like, right. this is really how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
Like saying that to be
exactly.
like,
I'm being direct.
Maybe they don't understand that they're making you feel that way.
Right.
Because it's a really shitty feeling
yeah.
to leave an appointment feeling like you weren't heard. It's right. a shitty feeling anywhere to
exactly.
feel like you're not heard. It's
exactly.
actually one of the worst feelings
That's
ever.
That's 100% the worst feeling.
And you feel like if we're looking at it from a mom's perspective, because that's what this situation was, there's a lot at stake here. Like, it's not just yourself. You're trying to advocate for your child.
Yeah.
And when you feel like you're not doing that as a mom,
yeah.
there's no worse feeling in the
exactly.
world. If you feel like you can't give your child what they need,
yeah.
absolutely awful.
Yeah. And you can do that in a respective way.
Definitely.
That's both respectful to yourself and your situation
right.
and the, and
you
the
have
healthcare,
to be saucy
healthcare
about it.
Provider's time. And that's where that IU language comes
yeah,
into play.
Absolutely.
So I feel... we feel this way, not you aren't or you are
right,
doing X,
right.
Y, Z, right? But
you're
we
not taking
feel,
me seriously.
Yeah. I feel like I know I present as like an anxious person
yep.
sometimes, but I'm confident in saying that in this scenario, that's not what's happening. I feel fully confident mm-hmm. that I have every reason to believe or to be this worried about something. Can we talk about other options
mm-hmm.
or can we look at a different
mm-hmm.
treatment plan or can we discuss what might be happening here? Because I feel like there's a disconnect in our communication. I'm not sure that we're understanding each other like we should be. You know, going back to that model of communication, there's noise happening, whether it's their busy schedule or the overload on testing or whatever. It might take 6 months to get this test done, but I still think it's valuable to do it. Can we get a referral for it? You know, just talking about all of that out loud, I think is helpful. In healthcare as well, like there is unconscious biases in healthcare. Research shows that depending on your gender and race, like you are treated differently. And it's not a personal intent by the certain healthcare provider. They're not necessarily trying. But as human beings, we all have unconscious biases. And if those aren't being recognized, we see there's so much research to show like the detriments of that in healthcare. So I think as a female, as a mom, you do have to present your argument in a more instrumental way. So we may be socialized, like I said before, to be more relational, to communicate about communication. I don't like the way you're speaking to me. I don't like da 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 da. We need a stereotypically, you know, instrumental or male approach to communication is action oriented or instrumental. Both are very beneficial. Actually, the blending of the two is like ideally effective. It's not that one way is better than the other. It's the context you're using them in. And in this scenario, I think a bit more of instrumental language with a relational delivery is what's going to be successful. So saying like, I respect your time and I understand, I think there's some miscommunication here, but then going right straight to the point. I want this ordered, not waiting for them to tell you what they can do, right? I would like more blood work to be done. Can we talk about XYZ? Is it worth exploring this sort of scan or this sort of test? Because we're not having answers. It's affecting our quality of life. I'm advocating for my child. We need a new plan. Right? Like focusing on the action and being instrumental in that delivery, instrumental meaning action oriented in that delivery, I think may be beneficial in that scenario. Also, if the healthcare provider, depending if they're male or female, they may respond better to A or B, right?
Right,
so
right.
if they're male, they may understand a more action oriented approach to communication. If they are female, that relational delivery may, not always, but may go a little longer of a way for that. So considering those things may be helpful as well. Like in business, for example, I just watched a show and it had this in part of the show. It was so funny because it was a dramatized version of this, but we know in business, like the patriarchy lives on, right? So like there's a reason why we make 70 cents to a dollar, et cetera. That's a different episode. But our behavior actually, like women don't ask for what they want. Men do. They're action oriented. They're instrumental, right? We just feel happy to be involved, be at the table. But really, we can start asking, being direct for what we want, what we need, and what we expect. And we're allowed to do that. We're allowed to take up that space. We've been socialized not to, but we actually should be. And we're worried that we'll be labeled like a bitch or aggressive or whatever. And we probably will be, right? Like if I use the same communication behavior as my male colleague in the same class, I'm being labeled as a bitch and he's being labeled as assertive every single time. Assertive and aggressive every single time in a business scenario. There's so many research, like focus groups to prove this. There's like data on it. But we're getting better. We're getting better at understanding that we can't put people in boxes that way, right? A male can show a little bit more empathy without being labeled as weak. And a woman can show a little bit more assertiveness without being labeled as aggressive. Hopefully, that's some like we each have to do some work on that, right? To kind of unravel some of those labels. But what's happening is the reason why, like, we go into a job interview, for example, not saying I'm the best one for this job. We're just happy, like, thank you for your time today. Where our male counterpart is saying, this is why you should hire me.
Yeah.
Right? So being a little bit more confident, and again, you don't want to be too egotistical because that demonstrates negatively on your part, but being confident in your skills and being able to back it up with examples, why not, right? So, and part of that is a nonverbal experience of taking up space. So men often would sit, like, they take up more space when they sit down, they make their shoulders wider, they stand up a little bit taller, they may pace the room a little bit differently. That is all an exertion of power, intentionally or unintentionally. Women are taught to actually take up less space. So we cross our legs, we make ourselves as small as possible in a room to allow room for other people. That actually can be demonstrated as a weakness in some of our nonverbal communication. So yeah, I mean, as silly as it sounds, like, in this situation and in the public speaking situation, like, standing up really tall with your chest puffed and your hands on your hips for like a few minutes before you before you go into that situation is actually going to boost some of your, like, internal chemicals, and it's going to make you feel a little bit more confident.
I do that.
Yes. You remember that?
I do the power pose. 100%.
It makes you more confident.
Yes. Right?
So that nonverbal stimuli, like that change in your kinesics, your body movement, will tell your brain, oh, we're confident.
Yeah.
We're feeling good today. We got this. We know what we're talking about, right? So sometimes it's kind of like doing that self-perception check as well to do that, to go into some of these scenarios. But yeah.
You are something else. You got lots of info on communication. And the funny thing is like, we haven't even scratched the surface.
I know.
That's the thing about communication, which I knew this was going to happen,
yeah.
But it was really fun to kind of just get an overview of day to day, like, what can we do to kind of be better communicators?
Yeah.
And I feel like we've definitely got a few tips. I know I have to do a better job at listening, and I am trying my best.
We all do.
It's real, like, as Sarah was saying, it is really hard to listen. And I remember I was in I can't remember if it was my class or a meeting a few months ago. And I have to work at understanding, like, when is sharing too much,
yeah.
And when should I listen?
Yeah.
And my professor said that if there's five people in the room, you divide your time by five people.
Right.
However long the meeting is, or however long the class is, divided between five people. Same with a meeting. If you're in a meeting for 1 hour, you should be speaking half of the time.
Right.
And I thought that was a really good tip. So yeah. I wanted to end on that little tidbit. Before we go, what can someone do today to make them a better communicator?
Just, oh gosh.
One thing. What's your top thing?
Interpersonally?
Like, yeah, let's go with
that. In their relationships or public speaking?
Yeah, no, interpersonal.
I think we have to become, I think self-awareness is key.
Yes.
And becoming more self-aware will create more effective communication on your part. And I think a part of that is recognizing the difference between the truth and the stories we tell ourselves. And we all tell ourselves stories all the time. So-and-so doesn't like me. So-and-so thinks I'm this, that, or the other thing. These people want to hang out without me. My partner's interested in other people. Whatever it is, we tell ourselves these stories all the time based on our experiences. And we all have different experiences based on our family life and our culture and our gender, the way we've lived our lives, our past relationships. It all influences. Like, you take a little piece of everyone you've ever known into who you are today, right? That's something like that. Who we spend our time with, like, emotional contagion is a real thing. Who you spend your time with, who you share your energy with, that is going to reflect back on you. So there's emotional contagion. If you're always around negative people, that negativity is going to seep inside your bones. If you're trying to be as positive as you can, people around you will, that is contagious, that they will receive that positive energy. It doesn't mean we're saying be toxically positive, right? But it's just understanding that how you feel and how you communicate those and feelings impact other people and vice versa. So I think when you have thinking about your perception of people, places, and things, you have to ask yourself, is that something I believe based on my own experience or based on facts as I know them? Or is it a story I've told myself based on someone else's opinion or someone else's belief or what I was told when I was a kid? Like, your self-concept, what you think about the relatively stable set of perceptions you hold of yourself, when you're young, like, really it's your family that's creating that. And we hold on to those sometimes, right? Like, you're the funny one, you're the smart one, you're the athletic one, you're the whatever. And then as you grow and your identity evolves and you don't have that anymore, you're like, who the heck am I? So really asking yourself, like, is this a story that I tell myself based on whatever our relationship is, or is this true? And then being able to communicate your way through that. So like, I'm feeling this way. I don't know. I think you're mad at me. I don't know if you're mad at me. Can we talk about it? Did I piss you off? Is something wrong? Da, 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 da. Being able to communicate your thoughts and feelings a little bit more effectively or a little bit clearer in your relationships, I think. Yeah, I think that'll be a start. Becoming more self-aware. Understanding that how you feel about yourself impacts how you communicate with other people.
Yeah, like what do they say? What Sally says about
Susie. Says more about Sally than Susie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what you're saying about other people is a window into what you're willing to say about people when they're not there, right?
Right.
And one of our satisfying relationship or positive climate is being able to protect people when they're not in the room. Like what right. you say about someone when they're not there says a lot about that relationship and says a lot about you, right? Less about the person you're actually talking about.
Right.
But how you're talking about yourself to yourself matters too, because that's going to impact how you participate in relationships. Like if you think you're not worthy or you think you're less than or you think whatever, then you're going to wonder why these people want to hang out with you.
Right.
So you're going to, that's going to impact how you communicate with them. Because if you think someone's going to leave all the time, you're going to communicate that way in some capacity, whether intentionally or unintentional. Mm-hmm. Because our communication is intentional and unintentional, right? We do it sometimes on purpose and we send messages all the time that we may not be intending to send verbally through our language and nonverbally through our actions. So, you know, that you're always sending messages. As human beings, we are meaning makers. We are making meaning all the time. We attach messages to things or meaning to things all the time. So I think be really conscious of that. And the last thing I'll say is that ego involvement means that we believe at our core that we're good people trying to do good things. And when someone, and this leads to the defensive listening thing a little bit too, Jess, like if someone comes for that in some way or insults that in some way, we might have really strong reactions to it. Because if we feel like we're a good person doing a good thing, or we're really good at XYZ and someone's coming in to say, no, you're not, that's kind of cutting away a piece of our identity. So being able to kind of take a step back and take a breath and perception check and consider the reasons. Here's reason one why that's happening. Here's reason two that that might be happening. Here's reason three why that might be happening. And evaluate like which one of those feels the most true. And I'm going to form my reaction or my message based on that. I think that will lead to more effective communication. Mm-hmm. If you're always being impulsive or responsive without taking a step back to think about it and to really assess how you're feeling, that's when that miscommunication happens, right? We've talked about this before. Like you get an email, you respond right away. You're like keyboard worrying it and you send it. And the next day you're like, oh no, that's not what I meant, right? Like,
right.
You know, you never respond when you're spiraling from a loss. Right. I always say, you never make a life decision when you're spiraling from a loss is what I say often too, right? Because you need a minute. You need to take a beat. So that's when
24
like,
hours.
Yeah. You write that email. You save it in your draft.
Let it marinate.
You read that text message. You're angry. Yep. You're in a fight. You're in an argument. Mm-hmm. You're going to say things you don't mean. But like communication is irreversible. Mm. Once you say it, you can't unsay it. You can be forgiven, but it will not be forgotten. So that's when you like, okay, I'm going to respond to this text in 24 hours. I'm going to write it in my draft. I'm going to, you know, write it in my notes app. Then I'm going to decide when to send it. And most times you're going to go back and edit that draft before mm-hmm. you send it. Because with some time comes perspective. And with that comes a little bit more clarity, I think, in your relationship. So I think becoming self-aware, increasing your self-awareness about your communication behavior and understanding that you can always be improving it will no doubt lead to more effective communication and therefore more positive relationships.
Well, there you go. You heard it here first, folks. Sarah and I are, I guess we're kind of like wrapping up season three here.
Yeah, a couple more to go.
A couple more to go. And we have an exciting season four.
If we had a physical vision board, it'd be so interesting to show it from year one to year to yeah. season four will mm-hmm. be the next season. Because mm-hmm. like, we've been manifesting that shit.
It's happening.
We've been manifesting it.
Things keep happening. And then I'm like to Sarah, like, because what did you say man, what did you say? You said something. It was like a quote of like,
what you think about, you bring about.
Yeah. So then I just sent her a meme of like $1 million.
Yeah.
So it was like, how?
Yeah. What you think about, you bring about. I believe that.
How can I bring in a mill?
Yeah.
You know, that would change everything for me right now.
Yeah.
Change everything for a lot of people. Yeah. So we have a very, very, very exciting season 4 coming. Kind of like, if you thought the rebrand was big.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Bigger. This is like the rebrand's
baby, kind of.
Yeah,
like, you know what I
mean? The rebrand had a baby.
Yeah.
This is it.
This is it. It's pretty fun.
So we're really excited. We'll have more on that.
Yeah, I also think a fun thing maybe we'll do in the next season as well is maybe do a few more episodes, or maybe some of our S&J sessions will turn into like some sleep tips and some communication questions. We'll kind of field those as we go on versus like dedicated episodes. But I know there's lots that people still have questions for you in terms of sleep and infant sleep and toddler sleep and maybe adult sleep.
Yeah. And I think that naturally it will come from
our conversations.
Right?
Yeah. Just about relationships. And like, we could do a whole episode on talking to your romantic partner. Okay.
Well, husbands are on next.
Exactly. So. Or like, we talk a lot about friendships, like how to communicate in friendships and how that changes what stages you're in and all that stuff. So there's lots more to talk about there as well. But yeah, season 4.
It's going to be good.
It's going to start off with a bang, I think.
Can't wait.
Exciting end to season 3 too. A few more episodes to kind of round this one out, and then onward and upward.
Thanks for chatting and sharing all your knowledge with us.
Thanks.
Appreciate it so much. I always learn something when I talk to you. Sometimes I don't want to hear what you have to say.
Sometimes
but
you
I had
hate
an
that.
Open mind today.
Sometimes you hate that.
For the podcast.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, I always enjoy our time together.
Me too.
It's nice to catch up. And Sarah and I will go months without seeing one another, and then we'll see each other 3 or 4 times in the same week, which is what's happening right now.
Twice in one day. And we're like, what?
Who do we think
forgot
we
about
are?
This? Yeah, it's amazing.
So we'll be back.
One last one-liner for you, since I always have these sayings. I think we've shared it on this podcast before, but I feel like it fits the theme of this conversation, Jess. So I'll repeat it. But when your friend or partner or colleague or whomever is coming to you venting about something, don't necessarily jump right to advice. I'm guilty for this. I give advice and I think I'm helpful, or I think I'm being helpful, but not everyone wants that. We just want someone to listen, and just we want to get it all out, right? We want to verbalize it. So we've talked about before, a great response is, do you want a solution or comfort? Do you want solution
what do you
or
need
comfort?
Right now?
Like, I've started asking you that a few times. Like, do you want comfort or solution? And you're like, I just want comfort. And I'm like, okay.
If you give me a solution, I'm going to literally freak.
So I'm like, let's bitch and moan.
Yeah.
Like, let's just, let's get it all out and complain why this sucks. If you want advice or a solution, then I'm going to give you a solution. And maybe it's not going to be exactly what you want to hear, right? So sometimes we think giving advice is really effective. It's actually an ineffective way to communicate. It's not a super supportive way to communicate because it's not always what our partner wants to hear. So I'll leave you with that. The next time someone's chatting with you or confiding in you, maybe ask before you speak, do you want comfort or a solution, so that you know the context of the conversation and you can proceed accordingly.
Good way to end.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, thanks again. We'll wrap up here and we'll catch you on the next epi.
Yeah. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us around the table on this episode of The Morning Meeting with Sarah and Jess. If you're enjoying your time around the table, if you like what you're hearing, tell us, tell a friend. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can like and subscribe. You can rate and review. We would appreciate it. It helps us. Help us help you. Make sure to subscribe so you never have to miss another Morning Meeting. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.
Today's episode is sponsored by one of our favorite local businesses, Island Folk Cider House. This female-owned local cidery crafts an incredible lineup of both seasonal and flagship ciders, including their best-selling Good Company and Rebel Rosé. I personally am a Rebel Rosé girly, but I mean, I love everything that has to do with rosé.
I love the crisp flavor of Good Company, Jess, but if I had to pick a favorite, it would be the Easy Peasy. Whatever your choice, you can trust that all Island Folk Cider is crafted with quality, local ingredients, never artificial. So, how do good folks like you get your hands on some Island Folk Cider?
You can visit their charming tap room in Sydney's North End at 52 Nepean Street. You can check them out at any NSLC location across Nova Scotia, or you can order online at www.islandfolkcider.ca with shipping available across Canada. Thanks again to Jill and our good friends at Island Folk Cider House.